Hello and welcome to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast supported by Jaguar. My name is Richard Moore. I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard. Lionel.
We'll be podcasting every day throughout the Tour de France, a daily pod, no less, for the Telegraph. And we're looking ahead to the Grand Départ in Yorkshire. We've all been here between about 6 hours and about 24 hours. It seems like longer, actually. 48 hours, wow. So what are you're the most recent arrival, Lionel. What are your impressions of the Yorkshire Grand Départ?
Well, it was very odd, really, driving up the M1 to go to the Tour de France. It feels slightly...
a mistake.
Yeah, it does feel very different to any of the Grand Departs I've been to so far. I know Leeds a little bit, and we're on the sort of... We're just outside the city centre in a large marquee. Our press area is a large marquee. So it kind of always feels a little bit unreal anyway, the start of the tour. Everyone's here coiled, ready to go, but it does feel particularly unusual this time.
We are tightly coiled, that's for sure. Daniel, we should say what we're going to be talking about in tonight's pod as well. We've got interviews with... we've got an interview with Greg LeMond towards the end, talking about Bradley Wiggins and Chris Froome. Some very interesting stuff from him. He's working at this Tour de France for Eurosport, his first tour that he's been at in its entirety since 1992, when he finished seventh. We've got Charlie Wigelius, who tells us a little bit about Garmin Sharp's reasons for leaving out David Miller. David Miller, of course, featured in our last podcast. And we've got a bit of Rolf Aldag talking about Mark Cavendish as well. Daniel, you've been in Yorkshire a couple of days. What are your thoughts and impressions?
Well, first of all, Rich, I'd confirm that you are very tightly coiled, wound up like a spring, aren't you? You've been very cantankerous today. Had a few run-ins with various people. But you seem
I'm
to
like
be fairly
Cavendish, Daniel. I'm really quite motivated for this.
I'm revved. Rich, if you were a rider and I had money on you for the Tour de France, I'd be very worried about your mental state at this point. Anyway, as regards the tour in Yorkshire, I would contradict what Lionel says slightly. It does feel strange in a certain respect travelling north to the Tour de France start, but once you're here, it just feels like you're on planet tour, and it really you're kind of abstracted from your surroundings, everything else that's going on in the world, and everything sort of fades into insignificance outside the kind of permanence of Race HQ, and everything's going on inside the race.
Yeah, but I would counter that by saying there is a Yorkshire feel even in here. Instead of the coffee, they're offering Yorkshire tea. Instead of the Vittel water in the press room, there's Buxton spring water. So, you know, little differences there. We're definitely not in France yet.
Little touches, but there's all the familiar uniforms of the ASO staff, the logo, obviously. Most of the people are speaking French. We've got the Garde Républicaine, the French police force, are here. We had Christian Prudhomme in the press centre earlier, Bernardino and Nick Clegg, the big three of the tour. So it's a strange kind of fusion of Yorkshire and the Tour de France. And Daniel and I spent the first evening in Yorkshire in York, and I felt York, a slightly smaller place than Leeds, had gone even more crazy for the tour. There, you everywhere you turned, there was some tour-themed poster or, you know, bunting. The Indian restaurant was offering Nan Brad with pictures of Bradley Wiggins. Slightly unfortunate that he's not riding. And the pubs had been renamed. You know, I drank a pint in the Le Swan, and you know that they're real. There was no escaping the tour. Here in Leeds, it's a bigger city, and perhaps not quite to the same extent has the tour taken over here. But certainly out in Yorkshire itself, and I understand Harrogate in particular, has gone tour crazy, and there are several things outside of the tour's control that probably will contribute to this weekend being enormous on the sporting calendar. Andy Murray being knocked out of Wimbledon, men's final on Sunday, of course, and England not being in the World Cup any longer. So the coast is clear, the path is clear, if you like, for the tour to really dominate the headlines this weekend. And the Royal Family are coming, aren't they? We've got Kate and William and Harry, I believe.
About this, I very much hope they come to the press room and shake everyone's hand, because I have very strong, very vivid memories of the King of Belgium. I can't remember which year it was, It's about 2002, 2003, and there's a stage in Belgium. The King of Belgium came into the press room. No, not Eddie Merckx. And he shook every, made a point of shaking every single journalist's hand. I have very fond memories of that meeting with the King of Belgium.
Well, I was actually standing with a Belgian journalist when Nick Clegg entered, surrounded by flunkies, adjusting mouthpieces and earpieces and looking very, very important. And I was standing beside a Belgian journalist, and I said, "Do you know who that is?" And he went, "It is the Duke of." And he was searching for where he might be the Duke of. And I said, "No, that's Nick Clegg." "Who?" And didn't cause too much of a ripple in the press room, it must be said. "Daniel, I hate to disappoint you, but I don't think the royal family are going to be coming anywhere near this marquee. They're going to be out at Harwood House."
That's very disappointing.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib.
So we'll turn our attention now to the serious business, by which we mean the pre-tour press conferences, which aren't really serious business, but they're as close as we get at this point in the build-up. Before we do that, we'll remind you that we'll be podcasting daily throughout the tour, as I said. Podcasts will be ready to listen to every morning. They should go up in the evening, but they'll certainly be ready every morning. Subscribe via iTunes to have them sent to you hassle-free. Now, the press conferences... What, Daniel, we attended a couple today, and I know Lionel was at Garmin Sharp and Team Sky. First one we went to was Trek, who unveiled a new sponsor, not so much a sponsor, more a partner, Samsung, as a sort of technical partner. Very unclear about how much money they're putting into the team. Not an awful lot, I would imagine, given the presence on the shirt is quite minimal. But it was interesting to hear and see Fabian Cancellara, the Schleck brothers, Danny van Poppel and Jens Voigt were the riders who were on the top table, as it were. Now, Andy Schleck cuts a sort of slightly sad figure these days. You know, still a young man who should be in his prime, but is nowhere near the level that he was at in 2009, 2010. He is the official winner of the 2010 Tour de France, yet here he is, age 29, and being presented as a support rider, not only for his brother Frank Schleck, but for Zubeldia as well, a rider who often finishes in the top 10, but certainly isn't going to trouble the podium. What do you make of Andy Schleck today?
The one thing you can say in Andy Schleck's favour is he has the self-awareness to realise how far he's fallen, and he even talked about the journalist perception of him, and he sort of said, "I know you guys don't think I'm a very good bike rider anymore," and he almost couldn't really defend himself against that. Sort of imagined charge. He sort of said, "Well, you know, I'm really not where I was. I'm really not where I want to be. I still aim to get back to, that sort of lofty position that he did once hold as one of the sort of big hitters in the Grand Tour, on the Grand Tour scene." Quite poignant, as you say, Rich. Someone who obviously. 2007, when he came in, finished second in the Giro, was touted as a multiple future Tour winner, and really now has been completely written off. And does he lack motivation? Are there other factors involved? I'm not sure. But really, in that room, I don't think you would have found anyone, Andy Schleck included, who would stake a single dime on him. Really lighting up this Tour de France.
He did, as well as the support role he had. He did mention possibly going for a stage, but you know that quote, it was quite poignant. He said, "Maybe some of you guys look at me and say he's not a good rider anymore, but I believe I am a good rider, or I wouldn't be here in the team. The first step is to help these two guys out. I will see during the Tour de France how I personally develop." As well as his head, it's almost as though his heart isn't really in it anymore.
Yeah, and I asked Andy, how he saw the next 2 years of his career panning out. And there's obviously a lot of uncertainty over that at this point. He doesn't look like he's going to contend for major tour honours again. And he answered very openly, kind of honestly, and there was no sort of edge, or he wasn't in any way defensive. But then asked his brother the same question, to talk about Andy's development over the next couple of years, and Frank was very prickly about it, almost as though he resented anyone asking that question at the start of the Tour de France, that they already had enough on their plate with the next 3 weeks, and they should really only be concentrating on that.
Fabian Cancellara obviously looked ahead to the cobbled stage. I think that's why he's in this Tour de France with no prologue. He should be a major factor in that cobbled stage on stage 5. Jens Voigt is here again, having said last year that he definitely wouldn't ride this year or ever again. He's 42 years old. And he did say again today that he probably wouldn't ride next year, but he did make sure that he added the probably in the next breath, saying that Trek was really trying to develop youth, and that isn't really compatible with selecting Jens Voigt for the Tour de France. But the youngest guy in the race, Danny Van Poppel, was beside him as well. He was very realistic about his prospects of challenging Kittel and Cavendish. In fact, he was asked whether he thought he could beat Kittel and Cavendish, and he said no. Also Greipel I can't beat. So he is pretty clear that he's in the next wave of sprinters behind those guys.
You mentioned the cobblestones there, Rich. Obviously a lot has been made of this stage. The consensus seemed to be today, I mean, both from Cancellari's team manager Luca Guercellena, I talked to him, and he was very doubtful about the possibility of people gaining or losing serious time. I mean, the first couple of cobble sections are quite spaced quite wide apart, and there's a reasonable amount of room to recover. You know, you sort of get your team ready in the eventuality that you do get dropped. You know, you get paced back, and the problem will be this sort of last 10 kilometres where there are a lot of closely packed, very difficult cobble sections. But the consensus today seemed to be that, you know, people might lose 20, 30, 40 seconds, probably not more, is the worst case scenario. What do you envisage happening there, Lionel?
Well, I think you're probably right, but yeah, it will be smallish gaps, but they will be significant enough gaps that the pecking order starts to establish itself before we reach the Vosges Mountains. And there will be somebody who loses 3 or 4 minutes. There just will be one of the people that you're thinking of for the top 10 who will be pretty much ruled out of the tour by that stage just because of a puncture or bad luck at the wrong time or a crash. It happened last time, it's happened every time the race has gone over the cobble. So it's almost like, you know, the deck of cards is handed out, and who is it that gets the, you know, gets the joker or whatever. Somebody will draw the unlucky card, and all of the favourites, Chris Froome, Alberto Contador and Vincenzo Nibali, will just want to limit their losses. I think if any of those guys lost 25, 30 seconds, that's not catastrophic. What they want to avoid is the tour losing mishap that could quite easily happen that day.
Now, you fellas were also at the Garmin-Sharp press conference. A bit of interest around that, given the controversy over their team selection. We presciently invited David Miller to be part of our long build-up to the tour with our special David Miller podcast, and thank you very much everybody who listened to that. There were quite a lot of you, so that's nice. And David looked ahead in that podcast to starting his 13th tour. Didn't occur to us, didn't occur to him that he wouldn't, and he even put on Twitter 10 days or so before the tour that he'd had his selection confirmed. So he did fall ill. He did pick up a bronchial cough, is how he described it. Which did affect his performances in the British Championships and the time trial and the road race. Didn't perform very well there. But there was no sense that I had or he had that his selection depended on how he performed there. So strange goings on. My own theory, and I wrote a little blog about this for the Cycling Podcast website. We will, incidentally, also be blogging every day from the tour, the three of us, on thecyclingpodcast.com. But my theory was that he's not had a great season. His form has been poor most of the year, and while David Miller is somebody you would back to get round the tour even in poor form, starting in poor form, I think the poor form coupled with the fears about his health, this illness that he had, meant that a difficult decision was made and he was left out. I don't know if you can shed any more light on it, having been to the press conference today.
Well, yeah, Jonathan Voigt has kind of backed that up and said that they had selected the Tour de France team after the Tour of Switzerland, and Charlie Wigelius had nominated the riders he thought should go for Garmin-Sharp, and David Miller was in that team, but that they had made a pledge that they would only select guys who were 100% healthy, basically felt after the British Championships, or the UK Championships, as Jonathan called it, that they didn't feel that David was 100%, and they felt they owed it not just to Andrew Talansky, who is their team leader, but also to the rest of the team. They'd made this pledge that they would pick nine riders who were 100%, and they didn't feel that David Miller was.
I talked to Jonathan a little bit, or asked him about the sort of new face of Garmin, and it was a very unfamiliar looking lineup there. We're used to turning up at the Tour and seeing Zabriskie, Vandeveld, Heijerdahl, Miller, and you really got the sense of a kind of new regime there, a new era. And you know, you looked at one side of the table and there was Charlie Wigelius, who was a fairly new addition to the staff, and then Talansky and Ben King, who's another young American rider, Alex Howes. And you know, I just wonder as well how much Talansky had his preferences. You know, I'm not suggesting that he doesn't get on with David, but perhaps there was a sense that he wanted his men there, and Charlie knew that. And also, I think, you know, David rode at Garmin for a long time under Matt White, who was a very good friend of David's, and David has spoken in glowing terms about, including in our podcast. And I think Charlie, in the short time that he's been a professional team director sportif, he's gained a reputation as someone who's quite hard-nosed, in quite ruthless, in a very good way. David was complimentary about Charlie as well, but completely different from Matt White. And I think Charlie looked at very objectively at
So you think Charlie made the decision rather than Jonathan Botters?
I got the strong impression today from the press conference that Charlie had a major, major influence.
Well, I asked Charlie about how difficult it was to make that call and actually, you know, physically make the telephone call to David Miller to tell him he wasn't going to be riding his final Tour de France. Charlie, first of all, how difficult a phone call was it to tell David Miller that he wasn't in the Tour de France for his final Tour team? You obviously go back a long way, both graduates of the Dave Rayner Fund, so you've known each other since teenage years, really. So presumably it was a difficult call to make.
Extremely difficult. It was very, very tough to do. But I was given a very clear task by Jonathan, which was to select the 9 best riders for the Tour. And obviously, you know, a healthy, strong David Miller is always going to be a part of that, also because of his huge experience. I think that at the end of the Dauphiné, his condition wasn't ideal, but he had time between the Dauphiné and the start of the Tour to improve. And his numbers began to improve, but then unfortunately he got sick. And it was, you know, I heard him on the telephone, it was a hacking cough. He needed antibiotics. And, you know, however, you know, painful it is, I also have a responsibility to the team and to the riders here to bring the best possible team that we could to get the job done. So unfortunately, you know, I couldn't let my personal feelings affect the decision.
And what about this start here in Yorkshire? You were brought up in York. You know the roads very well. You mentioned in the Garmin Sharp press conference that the first section of Stage 2 was your cycle route to school. And you reflected also on how far cycling has come. But when you were growing up and getting into cycling, what were your school friends? You know, what was their reaction to you being interested in what was quite a quirky sport?
Yeah, I really think quirky is exactly the word, because it wasn't something that people understood. You know, why do you wear tight trousers, and doesn't your bum get sore, and do you shave your legs? And, you know, it's not easy being different at school when you're that age. And I think there was probably quite a lot of curiosity, but it was obviously something in those days that was quite peculiar, you know, so times have really changed.
And when you see there's going to be hundreds of thousands of people out on the road, I mean, it's going to show just how far cycling's come in Britain particularly. But for you, being so familiar with the roads, it's going to be quite a unique experience in the team car, isn't it, over the weekend?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, from a technical point of view, the roads here, they don't make manoeuvres with the team car particularly easy. And I think that even the third stage, there's going to be sections where, you know, if nothing happens, the riders and the teams and the public will think that everything's okay, but the moment there's a problem, you can't get by with a car on those kind of roads. So it's definitely going to be challenging. And I think then from a technical point of view, if you could really compare it a lot with Corsica last year.
Did your local knowledge give you an advantage? Is there anything you can pass on to the riders about the opening weekend?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, particularly the first two stages, if I wasn't training on those roads as a young rider, I rode a lot of races around in those areas. And, you know, the descents in this part of the world are quite similar. They've got similar kind of characteristics. You can get extremely high speeds. And, you know, the geography of the roads and stuff, I think, you know. But nowadays, people are really quite well informed, so there can be an advantage, but it could also be quite minimal.
For those who don't particularly know much about Andrew Telansky, obviously we saw such a fine performance in last year's tour, but from the point of view of the Directeur Sportif, what's he like to work with?
I think that if you were to go back in history and find somebody you'd want to compare him to, it could be Bernard Hinault, because of his character, you know. He's got a strong character. He's got a racist character, and he's a tough guy, and he knows what he wants, and he knows how he wants to get there. So that presents, you know, a challenge to us to try and guide him through that in the best way. But I haven't been with the team for his entire career, but just the short time that I've been working with him, I can see him developing into a grown man and also a leader. So I think that's a good sign for the future.
He's nicknamed the Pitbull, isn't he? So who wins out of the Pitbull and the Badger?
Yeah, I think there could be a tough fight, probably quite illegal to put those two creatures against each other. But unfortunately, time machines don't exist, but it would be good to see the two of them go at it.
On the bike, you mean, rather than ripping hunks out of each other?
Yeah, definitely no contact.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Andrew Telansky was eighth overall last year in the Tour.
Done your research, Lionel. This should be in front of you on your notes.
Oh, it should be in my head. I'm sure someone will correct me on Twitter. But he was certainly in the top 10. And he was saying in the Garmin Sharp press conference that basically the whole team has been selected with one goal in mind, and that is for him to finish as high as possible on GC. And he said that may be 10th place, it may be 5th place, it may not be the top 10. That marks a real change, not just, as you were saying, Daniel, about the personnel change, but the philosophy of the team has changed completely. Last year they were a real kind of wild card team. They were going out hunting for stages, mixed things up a little bit. They, of course, pulled off that stage win in the Pyrenees, where they risked everything, really, to set it up for Daniel Martin. They were so committed to a plan to attack and to get riders in that break early on in that Pyrenean stage that they were prepared for riders not to make it inside the time limit. Whereas this year, everything is lining up behind one rider, which really is the first time that they've actually done this in the Tour de France since probably 2008-2009, and even then with Christian Vandeveld in 2008 when he was fourth or fifth, and Bradley Wiggins when he was third or fourth, depending on how you review the results, they weren't really going in with a sole leader. So it's going to be really interesting to see how Garmin Sharp pull off that strategy this year.
I wonder as well if as well as a sort of change in philosophy, there's a looking ahead. There are rumours that the sponsorship situation might be changing at Garmin Sharp. They've picked a team for the future. Picking David Miller would have been a sort of team from the past.
Yeah, and Jonathan Vaughters, he gave the very strong impression that the future of the team was secure now, and some kind of announcement might be imminent, whether it's during this Tour de France or shortly after the Tour de France. And he did talk about a long-term plan. He talked about almost a new phase in the life of that team. And Talensky, Jonathan turned to him at a certain point in the press conference and sort of whispered something to him, and Talensky nodded, and then Jonathan turned back to the journalist and said, and I can confirm that, you know, Andrew's going to be a part of the future of this team. He's signed a 2-year contract extension. So I think...
Sounds like he is the future of the team.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it is telling that David Miller, in our interview with him and in other interviews with him, has never mentioned Andrew Talansky. We don't know the nature of their relationship, but he's always spoken very glowingly of Dan Martin, and obviously he was very close to Vandeveld and the old guard who've all gone now. And maybe it is just a case of David Miller's face almost doesn't fit anymore.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboom, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Here we are then, Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, in a marquee in Leeds, which is not a line I ever imagined myself saying. It's a bit overcast, a bit grey, quite chilly, and we'll look ahead to Saturday's opening stage in the final part of the podcast. But Let's talk briefly about Team Sky, because they had a press conference today as well with the whole team. Chris Froome also faced the press on Wednesday. Any thoughts on the Team Sky press conference? It was, I mean, these things are... Garmin Sharp had their press conference at the hotel, which is more hassle for the journalists, but often slightly more relaxed affair. In the press centre, all the journalists are here, the TV crews are here, the writers shuffle in, they are kind of glassy-eyed, they look incredibly bored.
It's what we know in the trade as a goat, isn't it?
It's a goat. Chris Froome, I thought, is becoming a more accomplished speaker, I think, in these occasions. I don't get the sense from him, though, that he is as confident about his form as he was 12 months ago. I remember 12 months ago, there was a real sense of momentum, obviously, with the season that he'd had, and he couldn't... I remember him actually saying on the eve of the tour last year that he couldn't wait to get underway. He was really excited. This year I sense a little bit more apprehension about it. I don't know if that was your impression as well.
Yeah, and I think he made that point, didn't he, when he talked about the pressure of being the defending champion. And I thought Dave Brailsford made quite an interesting point that perhaps we overlook, in that we do talk about defending champions, and Chris Froome is defending his title. And Dave Brailsford said that in sport, they don't see it as defending anything. They see it as trying to go out and win the Tour de France for a third time, much more kind of positive rather than a sort of negative defensive thing. But certainly from Froome's body language, he looked quite comfortable at the centre of Team Sky's lineup there, but certainly wasn't as effusive about his form or chances. And when you think, you know, it just occurs to me there, Andrew Talansky was the winner of the Critérium du Dauphiné, and of course in 2013 Chris Froome won that race, in 2012 Bradley Wiggins won that race. And you know, Chris Froome is coming here as defending champion of the Tour, sure, but really with only the Tour of Romandy behind him.
Tour of Oman as well.
The Tour of Oman, but that's back in February, and it, you know, a real kind of early season race. The Dauphiné, there were mitigating circumstances. He crashed and lost time. He probably would have been on the podium but for that crash, but the final weekend he looked vulnerable. And he comes into the Tour with that as his most recent racing memory. And I think that must have some kind of psychological effect over a rider.
Yeah, and it's been 18 months now that Chris Froome has been in this pressure cooker of either being the favourite for the Tour de France or the defending champion or both. And I remember at the start of last year, Bradley Wiggins talking about this with he obviously had a very keen awareness of what it meant to be the Tour champion, what it meant to be the Tour favourite, and he'd felt, you know, very viscerally that the pressure that put under someone. And I think I might have mentioned in the podcast recently a conversation with the Française des Jeux trainer Fred Grapp, who... he's thought a lot about the kind of cumulative fatigue in a team like Sky, just by virtue of the workload that they subject riders to, and particularly the stage racers. And you know, he has doubts about the sustainability over that over several seasons. And you know, when you add that to the pressure, and you know, you think of the last two or three months, Chris Froome has faced allegations of doping, sort of illegitimate therapeutic use exemption. And you know, the build-up, lots of media commitments, press conference today, an awful lot of people there. It is a lot of mental energy that is taken up by that. And you know, you do wonder, it would only take 2 or 3% off Chris Froome's reserves to make a real difference, especially with, and I think this is another huge added pressure, and Alberto Contador, who this year has shown he's snapping at Chris Froome's heels, which it wasn't the case a year ago.
I wonder if that point that Dave Brailsford made was for Chris Froome's benefit in terms of trying to influence his mindset, his psychology going into the race, because Froome kept actually talking about the pressure of being the defending champion, and you know, he contradicted Brailsford repeatedly by mentioning this, and Brailsford made this point and tried to make it very forcefully, very strongly, and I wondered if that's been something they've been trying to drill into Froome, to disregard the past. This is a new race, a new event. What happened last year doesn't have any bearing on it. I just wonder. Now, of course, another point that Froome has made is that he feels this is the strongest team that Team Sky have ever fielded in the Tour, and that may well be true. But of course, it's a team that excludes Bradley Wiggins. And I think his absence will be mourned this weekend, not least by a curry house in New York, who might struggle with their Nan Brad although it did look quite nice. But we spoke yesterday, Daniel, we went and spoke to Eurosport's new cycling ambassador, Greg LeMond, who's, as I said earlier, set to complete his first Tour de France since 1992. And LeMond spoke a little bit about Bradley Wiggins and Chris Froome and the decision by Sky to exclude Wiggins, and it was interesting what he said, and here he is now.
Greg, you've been fairly outspoken about the Wiggins-Froome debate, and you've been fairly mystified that they weren't both accommodated. They couldn't both be accommodated. Of course, in 1986, or in 85 as well, you and Bernard Hinault were accommodated in the same team with kind of mixed and fairly, well, fairly interesting results.
First and second, both years.
But look at that. Look, imagine that, though. I would be left out to protect Hinault, or Hinault's left out to protect me. I mean, it's just not about me. It's about the sport. It's like he's defending. He's not another rider. He's a defending champion 2 years ago. He's not a washout. I think it's crazy, and I think it's from a sporting event, it's depriving even England of a great race. And I know but it's a professional team. They get to do what they want.
So do you think it's a failure of management to be unable to accommodate?
You know, the only thing I would say, if there's such a rivalry between Chris and Bradley, I can understand that. I can understand it. If it's irreparable, it can't be, you know. But it seems like they both should be professional. Mm-hmm. And like even 85, 86 was really an issue with Tapie. Then let's say Guimard was coach, 85, 86, it would have been a different race. We would have been working together. Guimard would have been saying, hey, listen, Bernard, you only won this race because Greg was here. Mm-hmm. So you owe it. And it doesn't matter. I mean, if Greg's better than you, I mean, if you're better, then he'll support you. That's how it's done as a professional. So I just look at it's more just the relative. It's not that Bradley is, he's not a has-been winner. That's 5 years ago. He's relevant. Especially, he was racing very well this year. But I could see at one point, it's turning back. You tell him he's not doing it. And I don't know all the intricacies of it. I don't know if he expected to do it. Because he announced, I think, earlier that he wasn't going to do it, so it's...
Who knows?
I thought it was a good PR stunt.
He played it perfectly.
Is there an argument, Greg, though, that there are certain riders who are a Class A rider as a team leader, but they're a Class D, E rider as a domestique, and that Bradley Wiggins is just, I wouldn't say worthless as a domestique, but...
I guess I don't know that. And it maybe that's that's the way he's been with the team, and I can understand that. I'm saying this is not a judgment on Chris, but it seems like there's some kind of it's just more of, I guess I'm looking at it as if it was a management decision, just the belief that the whole team needs behind one rider, and from a strategic perspective, and they're both getting along, and they both were professional enough to go, okay, once something conceded, even if it isn't, there's an advantage having two teammates. There was an advantage, both 85, 86, for both and myself. Roche broke away. What's he going to do with me on him? Breaks away or follows somebody. What are they going to do? We control both. We're first and second. So from that point of view, I don't know the intricacies. It was just, and I was looking more of a logical perspective. If you're a team and you're spending this much money and you've got a tour that's unlike any other tour in the past, 15 Ks of real cobblestones, just the risk of a budget of a team of whatever, 15 million euros, 20 million euros, you're riding. I think from a business perspective, this would be more philosophical, but that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning, and then you should insure yourself against possible failure. Because Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So we heard there from three-time Tour de France winner Greg LeMond, mentioned his famous battles in the 80s with teammate Bernard Hinault, parallels obviously with Chris Froome and Bradley Wiggins. We're now being refreshed. Daniel's run off to the bar here in the press room. And Daniel, what are we drinking here?
Got some free samples of a Chilean white, Conosur winery. I've got a little stand here, and they've very kindly supplied us with a very small measure of wine just to get us through the rest of the podcast.
Very small measures, so we'll probably have to go back for another one at some point. So, the final part of the podcast, let's look ahead to Saturday's first stage, Leeds to Harrogate. Obviously, Mark Cavendish is a favourite for that. We saw Cavendish earlier at his press conference with Omega Pharma. Quick Step was here earlier as well. What are your thoughts about... I thought it was interesting, Cavendish's press conference, and we chatted to his agent, Simon Bailiff, earlier as well, who also impressed upon us the fact that Cavendish feels very strongly that the tour does not end in Harrogate, or indeed Yorkshire, that it's 21 stages. He's, I think, feeling that there's rather too much emphasis on Yorkshire and on Harrogate in particular. It's unusual for him to seek to lessen the pressure. He's somebody who reacts well to pressure, but maybe it's getting to him a little bit too much. I don't know. I mean, what did you make of what Mark Cavendish said, Daniel, and what are your thoughts about Saturday's stage? Who do you think is going to win?
Well, I mean, if I can jump straight ahead to thoughts on Saturday's stage, the consensus seems to be that it's very complicated in a number of respects. The first part of the stage up to the last 50 kilometres is on very, very narrow roads. In fact, Omega Pharma Quickstep came to Recce the stage a couple of weeks ago, and they had GPS information from ASO. They followed it to the letter. They thought they were on the right roads, but after a while they were turning and looking at each other and saying, the Tour de France can't possibly be going over these roads. They're too narrow. The Tour would never be on these roads. And in fact, they were on the right roads. So that's going to be tricky, those first 100 kilometres or so. And then the last 50 kilometres are a lot wider, but they're quite concerned about the last 2 or 3 kilometres. Quite technical, not particularly twisty, but a lot of short rises, short downhill sections. And, they feel that if you get that wrong, you could lose 2 or 3 men from the lead-out train in the space of 200-300 metres. So it's a technical exercise and not just an exercise in speed. But on the other hand, they're very confident, I think, about Mark's health, his form. They were slightly concerned that he'd stayed in Tour of Switzerland for too long, trying to work for Tony Martin. But he seems to have come out of that pretty well, and I think they're pretty hopeful.
Well, Lionel, who do you think is going to win on Saturday? Let's cut to the chase here.
I've just got a feeling Mark Cavendish is going to do it, because this could be his one chance to wear the yellow jersey, as crazy as that seems. A rider who's won all those stages, never worn the yellow jersey as race leader, and I just think obviously the reason he feels all this pressure is because he's got the family link to Harrogate, with it being his mum's hometown. He's never worn the yellow jersey. It's a chance for him to do that if he wins the stage. And of course he's got this growing rivalry with Marcel Kittel, the giant German. That's probably why he feels like he's in the middle of a kind of Venn diagram of pressure that converges on him. But I've just got a feeling that it will go right for him on Saturday. He has looked good. He did look good in those sprint finishes in the Tour of Switzerland. He took the precautionary kind of measure of not riding the national championships on a course that wouldn't have suited him anyway. I just think everything's coming up for him, and we've analysed his grand tours over the years, and traditionally he's kind of somebody who I once made the mistake of suggesting to him that he's a slow starter in the Grand Tours, and he's corrected me on that and said that it's not that he starts any slower, it's just that he deteriorates less quickly than his rivals, and that's why he comes into his own after a few days when fatigue starts to add up, that cumulative fatigue that Daniel was talking about. But I just think he's got such an opportunity on Saturday. His team won't let him down, and it's going to be a real shootout, but I'm going to stick a few quid on Cavendish.
Yeah, I mean, you talked there about the cumulative fatigue. I think that was unusual about last year's tour, and that's what mystified him slightly, that he didn't improve, certainly in relation to the other riders, as much as he would usually do. Just about the lead-out train, there's been a lot of work done on it in Italy with Davide Bramati, one of the director sportifs. Pataki's been there. Various other elements of the lead-out train have been working hard on it. And before the Tour of Switzerland, I spoke today after the press conference to Rolf Aldag, who's the technical manager of Omega Pharma Quickstep, also obviously was a direct sportif of Mark's at HTC Columbia, and Rolf talked to me a little bit about the work that's been done on the lead-out train, and also how the last few months Mark has taken some time to kind of regain his trust in Mark Renshaw, and how that partnership is really back to its best.
I think we with Renshaw, obviously, we added some quality, but not only like physical quality. I think with having Renshaw in, like, we added some tactical skills. It's not only about pure horsepower. It's like somebody has to be the brain behind the horsepower. So somebody has to maneuver the train into the right direction. And that's obviously him. I mean, I think Mark and Mark didn't ride together for quite a while. They went different ways. And it took a little bit of time to reunite them, to find back that uncompromised trust, which is in place now. So from our end, we're pretty optimistic that we get it done. And that also puts us in a position to act later, to react on different things, not just to go like blindly from the front, but to say, okay, you know, we see how things are, we see how things go, and we can take last-second decisions in the race with having Renshaw there and not putting all the decision-making process and basically the responsibility for the result in Kevin.
I mean, it looked in Switzerland as though you weren't really interested in being on the front at 5K to go, even 4K to go sometimes. It looked like the key point was sort of 3-2. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, not everything went perfectly in Switzerland. I mean, that day when Mark crashed, well, we still didn't really do it perfectly. And that's also why he was kind of sitting up and saying, okay, too dangerous, and he still got caught up in the crash. So it goes from stage to stage. If it's really tricky, dangerous, then we might be in the front at 5. But in general, I think we understand that a lot of teams invest into lead-outs, and it's not like team time trial where you say, okay, the best time over the last 5 kilometers counts. It's just at the finish line, and we just learned our lesson probably the hard way that it's not always like the best to go from the front for a long, long, long time. So we try to adjust to it and try to get the best out of it. And I think with the team here, we have a good chance with people who get us out of difficult positions and into the right spot again to be able to do that.
And then Mark himself, how do you assess his health and form? Is he where he needs to be?
I think so. I mean, we will all have confirmations after the first couple of stages. But now if I see him now, if I compare him to last year or the last 2 years, I think he's better than he was there. He got sick last time in British Championships. He wasn't super with his health all the way through from Switzerland. But it also shows his motivation and shows like his spirit, because he just wasn't willing to give up having Tony in the yellow jersey. So probably just purely on paper, it would have been more smart to stick to the end, to leave the race early instead of stick on to the end of the peloton to the last stage. But he really wanted to give back to Tony and show commitment that what he expects from everybody in the tour. He wanted to like kind of give that back to Tony for all the years, which kind of honors him, which put him a little bit into that not jeopardy, but that little bit of we have to be careful with what we're gonna do. So please don't travel all over Europe. Please don't. Don't do extra crazy stuff in cold rain or anything. So that was the only thing to say. With that decision to stay in Switzerland and not leave early, we had to be careful with him to get him in good shape to the tour. And good health. Good shape would be the wrong word. In good health, because in shape, I think there's no doubt. I was personally in Switzerland on that stage that Trentin won. So that second category climb and third category climb, and I've seen Kev there from the car. And the way he pedaled, the way he was sitting on the bike, if it would have been the Tour de France that day, he would have made it to the finish and be there for the sprint. So I think he's really, really good. Obviously, the others will be really, really good. The main contenders will be really, really good. And then we will see. But yeah, that's sport.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Okay, well, that was Rolf Aldag. I'm going to head off to the team's presentation now and see what all the fuss is about in the Leeds Arena, see whether the tickets are worth the 80 quid that they're charging. I'll report back on that in our next podcast, which will be Saturday. So that's all from me. Lionel, anything more from you?
Well, I was just going to direct people in the direction of thecyclingpodcast.com, where we are blogging daily. We're taking it in turns to write something about the race. Today's blog, we did a sort of quick-fire questionnaire about the tour. And some
questionnaires, or one questionnaire in particular, was more quick-fire than the others, wasn't it, Richard? Busy morning this morning, was it?
I was busy, very busy.
So Richard gave sort of one, two-word answers. Daniel and I were a little bit more effusive about our thoughts. But we've answered all the obvious things: who we think is going to win, who are going to be the main figures in the race, what we're looking forward to most. So check that out on thecyclingpodcast.com and click on the link to pods and blogs.
So remember, we'll be blogging and podcasting every day. We're going to have Ciro Scognamiglio, our friend from Gazzetta dello Sport, popping up regularly on this Telegraph cycling podcast supported by Jaguar. Daniel, anything more to add before we head off?
Not really. Ciro and I had a Pippo Pozzato exclusive tonight, and also quite a fanciful suggestion from Ciro about what Pippo should probably be doing this time next year. But we're going to wait.
Ciro's on, and we'll break the Pippo news then. Yep. Great. Well, thank you very much, Daniel.
No worries.
Thanks, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Cheerio.